This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
In a meeting with WHO and the Ministry of Health in Namibia yesterday, the point that was made is that this is worse than the worst possible case scenario predicted 18 months ago.
That's Stephen Nari, Project Hope's regional director, on the current wave of COVID-19 in Africa. Details coming up. Also, the World Food Program has resumed operations in Ethiopia's Tigray region. And Burkina Faso's president fires his defense minister. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Project Hope, a global health and humanitarian organization operating in more than 25 countries, warns that the current COVID-19 wave in Africa is likely to be even more devastating than previous surges. Coronavirus infections have spiked again across Africa, with the highly contagious Delta variant spreading to more countries. A growing number of hospital isolation units are overflowing and unable to provide adequate care. Stephen Nari, Project Hope's regional director for Africa, explained the seriousness of this spike to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy.
I would say this is more than serious. It's devastating. At this point, literally everybody has been personally impacted, with friends or family members who have passed away. You know, here, if someone gets critically ill in the current environment, they may not be able to receive the intensive care that they need. I just want to put that in perspective. Across many of the nations in southern or eastern parts of Africa, there are about somewhere between 1 and 6 intensive care unit beds for every million people. In contrast, in the U.S., there are about 300 ICU beds per million people. So we're hitting capacity more quickly, and most of the countries have run out of vaccines.
So what makes the third wave of COVID-19 different from the first two waves in Africa?
First, what makes the third wave different from the first is the presence of the Delta variant. The greater transmissibility and disease severity of the Delta variant is alarming, especially among a population where less than 1% of the people have been fully vaccinated. Another thing that makes this different is the scale of the third wave, the sheer number of cases that are being reported per day. In public health, we standardize the way we count and we look at the number of cases per 100,000 people. So if you were to look at a graph of the past 18 months for, say, Namibia, Zambia, Rwanda, DRC, you see a relatively flat line for the first 6 months, and then you see a small bump. That's the first wave. Then a little bit later, you see a slightly larger bump. That's the second wave. And then you see this massive spike, and that's this third wave, but it's not a wave anymore. And what makes this particularly scary, and the point that I want to make, is that that spike is still on an upward trend in many of these countries. In a meeting with WHO and the Ministry of Health in Namibia yesterday, the point that was made is that this is worse than the worst possible case scenario predicted 18 months ago. So basically, even the experts couldn't predict that it was going to get this bad. So we have a health disaster looming here, and it could have been avoided if the countries had received more vaccine doses sooner.
Project Hope warns that the vaccine gap between the high-income and middle- and low-income countries and the lack of vaccines across the continent highlights the gross inequality of access to public health interventions. How would that delay the return to pre-pandemic normal in the African continent?
First, the biggest gap is that we've run out of vaccines, and the only way to get ahead and stay ahead of this virus and its variants is through vaccination. So the continent must receive more vaccine doses now, not 2 or 3 months from now. Only around 1% of Africa's population has been fully vaccinated. Globally, out of 2.7 billion doses administered, less than 1.5% of those have been administered in Africa. Southern African nations are going in the opposite direction of pre-pandemic normal. countries are going into strict lockdowns. Schools are closed. Restaurants are closed. Travel is restricted in country. Curfews are in place. It's hard to picture the African continent going back to pre-pandemic normal anytime soon. On the one hand, we have a hope that there will be lessons from every country to strengthen their health system and develop a stronger pandemic preparedness and response mechanism. We hope that there'll be changes for the better. On the other hand, we're seeing various health progress being reversed, such as access to primary health care. It will still take a few years for us to get back to a pre-pandemic normal there. Similarly, poverty resulting from food insecurity has been on the rise, and that's causing cases of malnutrition. This isn't going to change overnight, even when the virus does disappear.
That was Stephen Neri, Project Hope's Regional Director for Africa, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy. The World Food Organization reports it has resumed its humanitarian operation in northern Ethiopia's Tigray province, but says lack of security and other impediments are threatening its ability to reach millions of people in need. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Humanitarian agencies were taken by surprise by the Ethiopian government's declaration Monday of a unilateral ceasefire in Tigray and by the speed with which Tigrayan forces retook the regional capital, Mekele. World Food Program Emergency Coordinator Tommy Thompson says 35 WFP staff on the ground were trapped and operations were suspended for about 48 hours. He says things have been moving quickly since the resumption of operations. He says the WFP has reached 40,000 people with food aid. However, he notes conditions on the ground are very difficult. Speaking on a telephone line from Mekele, Thompson says WFP staff cannot move freely and do not have access to all areas in the region. He says electricity and phone networks have been cut off since Monday and all commercial and humanitarian flights have stopped.
We have no incoming fuel supplies. We have no incoming food supplies to feed the people in Tigray at this point, so we're only operating with what we've already had pre-positioned. The banks are all closed and currently are without money, even if they were open. So funding operations is becoming critical at this time.
Thompson says several non-governmental organizations are considering suspending operations because they have run out of fuel and money. He adds WFP only has enough fuel left to run its fleet of trucks in northwest Tigray for 2 weeks. Thereafter, the driving will stop. The situation became even more difficult on Thursday when a bridge over the Dakhazi River was destroyed, cutting a main supply route between western Tigray and the rest of the region. Despite these obstacles, Thompson says he believes conditions for the distribution of aid will shortly improve. He says high-level discussions on all sides of the conflict are taking place to agree on designating corridors for aid delivery, including an air bridge.
I'm cautiously optimistic that at least an air bridge might be available in the coming days. If it is, that would be an absolute enormous assistance to us to move staff in and out, to move cash to operational areas, and to really assist us in a great number of ways.
WFP aims to scale up its humanitarian operation in Tigray to reach 2.1 million people, among them 350,000 on the verge of famine. To reach this goal, it says it needs unfettered access to all affected areas and $176 million to run its life-saving operation through to the end of this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And in more news from Tigray, the destruction of the Takaze River Bridge and other incidents raised questions over the ceasefire's fragility and how much worse the world's biggest hunger crisis in a decade might become. Aid groups were looking into reports of other key bridges destroyed. Damaka Mekonnen Hassan, Deputy Prime Minister of Ethiopia and Minister of Foreign Affairs, denied Ethiopian forces were responsible.
The insinuations that were trying to suffocate the Tigrayan people by denying humanitarian access and using anger as a weapon of war is beyond the pale. This is absolutely no reason for us to do so. These are our people, and the fact of the matter is what we are using every ounce of our strength to extricate them from the dire situations they find themselves in at the moment, and this is indeed our duty.
Hassan added that the Ethiopian government has detailed a roadmap for inclusive dialogue to resolve the Tigray crisis and ensure lasting peace and stability in the region.
The Ethiopian government has elaborated a roadmap for inclusive dialogue to resolve the Tigray crisis and ensure lasting peace and stability in the region. This dialogue process is expected to involve legal opposition parties, rank and file members of the TPLF who show readiness to choose a peaceful path, the business community, civil society organizations, elders, other prominent personalities.
Ethiopia's government has said the ceasefire will last only until the end of the crucial farming season in Tigray, which means September. The Tigray forces, emboldened after retaking the regional capital this week in a stunning turn in the 8-month war with Ethiopia's military, have taken control of key towns this week, and several thousands of its fighters had been seen to be moving west. The spokesman for the Tigray forces this week told the Associated Press they would liberate the region from enemies, including the Ethiopian forces, Amhara forces, and soldiers from neighboring Eritrea. The UN Security Council was to hold an open meeting late today on development in Tigray that would include political and humanitarian briefings. In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, scores of former rebels this week began to protest what they call intolerable conditions in the transit camp where they are staying. The men surrendered to armed forces of the DRC or FARDC and were promised help returning to civilian life. Their protest comes days after a number of attacks in the region, some of which are blamed on the ADF, or Allied Democratic Force, a group of militants operating in the region. Reporter Jafar Al-Katanti is based in Goma and has been covering the protests. He spoke with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson.
Yesterday, Thursday, the road of Sake, the road from Goma to Sake, was barricaded by ex-Mai Mai combatants who are in a transit site in Mubambiro. It's around 20 kilometers from Goma, but just very near Sake. And they say they are in a very bad condition, to the point that 7 of them died of hunger. And they blocked the road, asking for all cars to pay them so that they buy food because the government is giving them anything to eat. And that situation was very bad to locals of Sake also, because as the camp is very near of Sake, people are scared, thinking that if that situation continue, those militia can be very dangerous for the locals of Sake, or they can return in the bush.
How large are these transit camps? Let's get a little detail about the transit camps and what their purpose is.
It's around 1,000 farmer militias inside, and they came from different army groups, so they don't obey to one person. They are just living there with the security of some FRDC, 10 or 7 guys with weapon. And when they are angry, they can control those military for their security and leave out of the camp. And that's what they did. They are there since long time. Some of them are there since 3 months, and the newcomer had 1 week, and all of them had not not anything to eat for a long time.
These protests by the former rebels, they're coming at a time of where we've seen several attacks by militias, particularly in the Beni area. What's the overall security situation like there in the east?
It's not only Beni, but also near Bunia in Mahage and Komanda. The security situation is not good. As you know, the army is in many operations and militia are supporting themselves too. When the FRDC is attacking a side of one or two militia, other militias try to attack another area so that the FRDC will be divided to the second point. And the last attack of Beni was did by IDF, which is a terrorist group, and it's a problem for the security of Beni city, because it was in the Beni city, and people are thinking that even the state of siege will not succeed, because during the state of siege there are many attacks than before the state of siege.
That was journalist Jafar Al-Khatanti speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson from Goma. On Wednesday, Burkina Faso's president sacked the country's defense minister after widespread protests on Saturday against insecurity. The president has now assumed the role of security minister himself. Henry Wilkins reports from the capital, Ouagadougou, on what this could mean going forward.
Burkina Faso's president, Roch Kabore, on Wednesday announced the sacking of Defence Minister Cherif Sai, who has been in office since the country's conflict with domestic terror groups started in 2015. His replacement? The president himself, along with a minister delegate, Colonel Major Ami Simpore, who's been appointed to assist the role. At the beginning of June, Burkina Faso saw its worst terrorist attack on civilians since the conflict with armed groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State started. At least 138 were killed in the village of Solhan. The attack triggered a wave of protests against insecurity which swept the country last weekend. Calls for Sai to step down were one of the protesters' major demands. Security Minister Oseani Compaoré was also sacked Wednesday night and replaced by Foreign Affairs Deputy Maxime Kone. So what does this reshuffle in leadership mean for the country? Siaka Koulibaly is a Burkinabe analyst and activist.
L'opinion est très mitigée.
He says public opinion is very mixed. Even if some accept the minister's departures as a concession, it's dubious as to whether it's enough to reverse the negative effect of terrorism across the country. Will the reshuffle be enough to calm the anger? It all depends on whether there are new attacks, he says. The fighting in Burkina Faso is at its most intense in the east of the country and in the northern province of Sahel. A local official from the tri-border region of Sahel province, where Burkina Faso's border meets with Mali and Niger, said he is hopeful things will change after the reshuffle. Since Cherif Sai has been in office, he says there have been attacks and discontent like in northern communities of Solhan, Markoy and Barcelogo, where 11 policemen were killed in a late June ambush by insurgents. That's why people wanted the president to change the ministers of defence and security. He says that since the marches, that's been done, so we think that things will change now. Smokey is a local hip-hop artist and co-founder of Citizens Broom, a civil society group which played a central role in ousting the country's former dictator in 2014, as well as in organising last weekend's protests.
D'autre part, nous pensons que ce n'est pas suffisant.
He says this is not enough for virtuous governance. It's necessary to tackle problems at all levels of the state, and not only those key ministerial posts. Philippe Mfraud is an associate professor at the University of Ottawa, an expert on security in the Sahel. Asked whether he thought the protests could escalate into a coup, as happened in neighbouring Mali recently, he said,
I don't sense a strong similarity with Mali in the sense of fragmentation within the armed forces or very strong inter-elite tensions that would typically be what goes into the recipe for a coup. So I don't think that Burkina Faso is kind of immediately in that kind of risk zone.
Meanwhile, opposition leader Eddie Combuego said the reshuffle will not be enough to return security to the country. The opposition is determined to push ahead with further protests this weekend. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
Senegal recently passed a new anti-terrorism law. Opposition leaders and human rights groups say is too broad and could infringe on rights such as freedom of speech and freedom to protest. Amnesty International researcher Ousmane Diallo spoke to Ricky Shryock about some specific issues the new law poses to freedom of privacy and more.
For example, some of the new additions to the Code of Criminal Procedure establish and or further establish a regime of the interception of electric communications. And what is appalling about this new article is that so there are specific cases in which they could be done for criminal matters and also for other delicts. And in order to do investigations, and there are some exceptions, such as that members of the government, of magistrates, and of lawyers cannot be, their communication cannot be intercepted. So for the lawyers, it cannot be intercepted without knowledge. But the thing is that there is no guarantee about the legality of those interceptions, like no authority, independent authority, that can assess whether there is enough information to allow for those interceptions to be done. More appallingly, the law clearly states that there is no recourse available when those interception of electric communications are being underway. Like there is no recourse for lawyers or anybody. So if you are being put under interception, it will be done. It can be renewed every 4 months, and there is no way that you can challenge that.
Protesters against this new law did take to the streets after it was passed. And can you tell me a bit more about what their complaints, what their worries are?
The opposition and civil society took to the streets because first they were, they went into the circuit in a very fast time. I think the draft law was signed by the government on the 15th of June. And by the 25th of June, it was already being voted by the National Assembly. So there was really no time for the opposition, and most importantly for the population, to get hold of the law, to read it, to see what is in it. But the opposition and the civil society organizations, especially human rights organizations, have pointed out that the law includes dangers to freedom of expression, freedom of peaceful assembly, and right to privacy, because the definition of what could constitute terrorism has been expanded to include acts of violence that could be committed during the demonstrations.
Do you think this new law could have an impact, and if so, what kind of impact on efforts to protest or organize against the government? Because protest has been and is such an integral part to Senegalese democracy.
I think this new law will certainly have an effect on protests and other peaceful ways of challenging the government through public gatherings, because any act of violence could be described as terrorism, and the organizers and the participants could be charged for terrorism, and this poses a challenge. And beyond that, I think the acts of violence and against public property and private property have been singled out in the new amendment of the criminal code, which makes us think naturally that this law was voted following the demonstrations of March 2021 in order to sanction and dissuade anybody from participating in those gatherings, not only the rioters but the peaceful protesters.
That was Amnesty International researcher Ousmane Diallo speaking with reporter Ricky Shryock. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Hayes Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Iyabaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05.